All right, we're in Mark chapter 14 this morning. In our last lesson, we were talking about the betrayal of Jesus by Judas and his arrest in the Garden of Gethsemane. We're going to read over that passage again and then pick up there and talk about some things that happened here, and then Jesus being brought before the high priest and the Sanhedrin and the beginning of his trial. But verse 43 of Mark 14 says, "Immediately while he yet spake, cometh Judas, one of the 12, and with him a great multitude with swords and staves from the chief priests and the scribes and the elders. And he that betrayed him had given them a token, saying, Whomsoever I shall kiss, that same is he. Take him and lead him away safely. And as soon as he was come, he goeth straightway to him and saith, Master, Master, and kissed him. And they laid their hands on him and took him." And pause there just a minute and notice a couple of things. First of all, how they came out to the garden after Jesus with staves and swords, sticks and weapons, as though they were hunting a terrible criminal, as though he'd done some horrible thing, as though he were violent, and they were afraid they were going to have to, fight him in order to arrest him. Jesus had never done anything like that at all, yet he's being treated this way. Partly because, of course, of their prejudice toward him, but also because they're afraid of him. And as much as they didn't believe in him, there was still something about him. And, we know the swords and staves ultimately had no power over him, but they are approaching Jesus as though he were just a common criminal, a thug that needed to be beaten in order to be taken. And then you have Judas, of course, who had given them this token that he would kiss the one who was to be arrested, which, of course, shows his treachery and his betrayal. It also teaches us something important about the arrest here, and we'll talk about that in just a minute, about why these events were illegal and never should have been done in the first place. But Judas came to Jesus, of course, and he called him master twice. But, of course, Jesus wasn't his master. If he were, Judas wouldn't be doing this. So he calls it master, but he's not treating him as master, which shows his hypocrisy. And I want to mention, too, at the end of verse 44, where it says, "Lead him away safely." Jerry asked me about this last week, and I had just skipped over it and didn't really think about it. But the word for safely there means securely. And so when Judas says to take him and lead him away safely, it means securely. Make sure you've got him and hold on to him. And so kind of the first thought when you think about when he says safely, maybe Judas was wanting to protect Jesus, but I don't think that's what it meant, even though maybe he didn't want him to be killed. In fact, when Jesus is killed, Judas comes back and throws the money back to those that he betrayed Jesus to, so maybe he didn't think they were going to put him to death. But he says to take him and lead him away securely, which seems like, make sure you've got him and hold on to him. Maybe Judas was afraid of what would happen to him if Jesus got away or something. But he's trying to give them a situation where they can arrest him and take control over him and then do what they want to do with him, so that he can get his money. That's what Judas was concerned about. And so they took Jesus, they laid their hands on him and took him, which is just a very simple statement, but fascinating when you think about who this is. This is Jesus, the Son of God, the creator of the universe, the one who made their hands, yet they're laying their hands on him, treating him as though, he were nothing, just a common man. But he of course, is God in the flesh. So verse 47 says that one of them that stood by drew a sword, and we know from the other accounts that this was Peter, and he smote a servant of the high priest and cut off his ear, and we know that this servant's name was Malchus from John's account. And we, of course, are reading about Peter doing what he had in his mind all along when he told Jesus, "Even if everybody else is offended, I won't be offended. Even if everybody else runs away, I won't run away. Even if they have to arrest me, even if they kill me, I'm going to stand by you." Because Peter thought, first of all, he thought he knew himself better than he really did. But secondly, he thought that this was going to be a fight. And if it's going to be a fight, Peter's going to fight. He's ready to brawl. And he brought his sword, and he's going to fight to the death to defend Jesus. And if that's the kind of kingdom that Jesus had come to establish, Peter would have been, you know, first in, been right at the charge, leading the way. But Jesus says, that's not how this is going to go. It's not that kind of kingdom. It's not going to be established, and it's not going to progress by violence. It's not about physical confrontation and fighting. It's about the teaching of truth and submission to God's will out of humility. And so Peter thinks that he's standing by his word, what he said he would do. But when Jesus stops him from fighting, and then again, the other accounts teach us that he picked up Malchus' ear and miraculously reattached it to his head, then Peter sees that this is not how he thought it was going to be. He's been wrong about it, and so with all the others, he runs away as well. So verse 48, Jesus answered and said unto him, "Are you come out as against a thief, with swords and with staves to take me? I was daily with you in the temple teaching, and you took me not. But the scriptures must be fulfilled." And they all forsook him and fled. And so this is being done partly for show, in the sense that the Jewish leadership is demonstrating that they are going to take charge of this situation and so forth. But it's also partly being done this way for secrecy. They're doing it in the darkness of night because they don't want the people to see how this goes down. They just want them to see the end result of what they have done here. And so Jesus says, you know, you could have come one day while I was teaching in the temple and arrested me. But they didn't want to do that. They didn't want that kind of publicity. They wanted to do it secretly. But they want the end result to be that Jesus is arrested, and if we, the Sanhedrin, arrested him, he must have done something wrong. Because we wouldn't arrest somebody who hadn't done something wrong. We're the leaders of the Jewish nation. We're the highest authority. We're the most holy people of all. And so once the fact was accomplished, they could then say, you know, you have to trust in us and our authority, and we wouldn't have done this if there weren't a reason for it. But if they had had to witness the arrest and seen Jesus, you know, what he was doing and his response and all of those things, it would have been different. And so they do it secretly, but they also want the result to be public. So as a result of this, they all forsook him and fled. And we left off last time in verse 51 and 52, where it says, "There followed him a certain young man, having a linen cloth cast about his naked body. And the young men laid hold on him, and he left the linen cloth and fled from them naked." And we were right at the end of the time, and I just mentioned that this was probably Mark. And I want to give just a couple of reasons for that. The truth of the matter is we can't say with certainty who this young man was because the Bible doesn't say. And people have speculated about all kinds of different individuals as to who this could have been. But the reason that most people believe it was Mark, and it seems to indicate that it was Mark, is because of a couple of things. One, the fact that he doesn't mention the name of this person is a statement of humility. For example, in John's account of the gospel, over and over he'll talk about the disciple whom Jesus loved. And he's talking about himself, but he never calls himself by name. He never says, "I, John," because he's writing about Jesus, and he doesn't make it personal as though he's trying to glorify himself or bring honor to himself or anything like that. He's trying to draw all the attention to Jesus, but there were things that he had witnessed personally that needed to be recorded and that the Holy Spirit was you know, telling him to record. And so he does so without calling himself by name. And it seems to be like that's what's happening here with Mark, that he was the one who was there, but he's not trying to make himself center of attention, but he is pointing out, you know, his mistake on that evening. Mark also fits the situation. From what we know about him, he was in Jerusalem, became a disciple of Jesus, and it's very possible that he could have been there on this occasion. So the most likely option is that this was Mark, and he's writing about himself. But we can't be dogmatic about that and say it's absolutely certain. It could be just somebody else that that we're being told about. But Mark seems to be the best guess, if you're going to guess. Ultimately, it doesn't matter. What matters is how it shows the fear that the disciples felt when Jesus was arrested. This young man was running away, and somebody grabbed him and grabbed his outer garment. And instead of letting them get him, he just took that thing off and let them keep his coat, and he kept on running. And when it says he ran naked, it doesn't mean he didn't have anything on, but it was his undergarment was all that he was wearing, which was technically naked, you know, according to the law. But nevertheless, he was trying to get out of there. He didn't want to be arrested, and Jesus wasn't resisting, and they're not fighting back. And so if you just stand there, they're going to take you too. And so he was running, and all of the disciples were running to get away. They forsook Jesus and fled. And that means what it says there. They were running away so they wouldn't be arrested. And whatever they had to do to make sure they avoided that, that's what they did. And so that brings us to verse 53, which begins the trial of Jesus. And let's just read a couple of verses, and then I want to take a few minutes and talk about some of the things that go on here. But verse 53 says, they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. And Peter followed him afar off, even into the palace of the high priest, and he sat with the servants and warmed himself at the fire. And the chief priest and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, and found none. For many bare false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. And there arose certain and bare false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. But neither so did their witness agree together. And then, of course, verse 60, they turned to Jesus. The high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee? But he held his peace and answered nothing. Again, the high priest asked him and said unto him, art thou the Christ, the Son of the Blessed? And Jesus said, I am. And ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Then the high priest rent his clothes and said, what need we any further witness? Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And some began to spit on him and to cover his face and to buffet him and to say unto him, prophesy. And the servants did strike him with the palms of their hands. So let's talk about some things here related to the arrest and the first part of the trial of Jesus. So the trial, here, of course, he's brought before the high priest. Remember that there were two high priests at this time in the history of Israel. There was the high priest that was recognized by Rome, and then there was the high priest that was recognized by the Jewish people. So Annas and Caiaphas were those two high priests at this time. And so in the first part of his trial, Jesus appeared before Annas, and then before Caiaphas, and then back before Annas. But they're all gathered together here. The entire Sanhedrin is the word. We're told that it was the high priest in verse 53, and then all the chief priests and the elders and the scribes. And that's what made up the Sanhedrin. So the Sanhedrin was the highest court in Judaism, if you will. Think of it like the Supreme Court in our system. And so you would have, you remember back when Moses was the only judge of Israel, and he was, you know, dealing with everything, and he received that advice from his father-in-law to delegate and to divide that out. Well, that system of hierarchy kind of continued. So you could have local judges, you know, in town matters and so forth, but the Sanhedrin was the final stop. And so it was made up of the high priest and then these chief priests and elders and scribes. So they have come together in the darkness of night to bring Jesus before them. They're going to have their trial and, of course, convict him of being guilty of something worthy of death, blasphemy. And then they'll send him to the Roman side for a trial. And Jesus will go before Pilate and then Herod and then back to Pilate. So there are two sections to Jesus' trial, and each one kind of has three parts. So in this part, there are a lot of things that have gone on here that are illegal. And I brought this book just to show you, if you've never seen it or never read it. It's called The Trial of Jesus. And it's written by a man named Chandler. His last name is Chandler, Walter Chandler. And he's a lawyer. He was from the New York bar. And he wrote this book to talk about, from a purely legal standpoint, what went on with the arrest and the trial of Jesus, both from the Hebrew side, the Jewish side, and also from the Roman side. And it's a fascinating read. If you ever have time to read it, it's when I started, you couldn't hardly quit. It's written as a legal brief, and he goes through point by point everything that happens, but it's not written, you know, like in lawyer speak. It's easy to understand. But I was going to look at the table of contents and just notice a couple of things with you that he talks about that were going on with the trial of Jesus, and reasons that he says the arrest and the trial were completely and totally illegal. And he mentions 12 different things here. First of all, he talks about the arrest of Jesus and why it was illegal. Number one, it's because it happened at night. So under the Jewish system, all of their legal proceedings were supposed to take place in the daylight and in open, in public. We read in the Old Testament about the gate of the city and how the men would gather at the gate. You think about the story of Ruth and how Boaz had to go to the gate of the city to make sure that the next of kin didn't want to marry Ruth and all of those things. They did their business dealings at the gate of the city, open, in public, before everyone. And the trials were to be done that way as well. So you didn't have a trial at night, and you certainly didn't arrest somebody at night. So it had to be done openly and in the daytime. So that was illegal for them to do this at night. It was also illegal to arrest someone based on the word of a traitor. Judas, of course, was a traitor to Jesus. And so one who had the motive to say something that would not be true because he turned against, you know, his former friend and is betraying him, you couldn't just take his word for it and arrest somebody based on that, especially based on that alone. You know, mouth of two or three witnesses. They talk about trying to get two witnesses to agree. Well, they should have had two witnesses to agree to the reason, you know, the indictment in the first place before Jesus could even be arrested. And so it was illegal because of that, because of who Judas was and because of what he did. So it took place in the night. It was something done by a traitor, someone who had an obvious motive against Jesus, which made it illegal. But it was also illegal because the charge to arrest Jesus came from the Sanhedrin. It's not legal for the judge to arrest somebody and then bring him into his court to have a trial, right? So if the judge already has determined this guy's done something wrong, and so I want you to go arrest him and bring him before me for a trial, you already know that it's not going to be fair. He's already prejudiced, and he's shown that. And we see that so often in our world, and even, you know, today always on the news, we see that kind of injustice taking place. But the Sanhedrin issued the arrest warrant, if you want to think of it in those terms, for Jesus. They had no right to do that. The Sanhedrin didn't issue arrest warrants. They tried cases. And so they violated the law in doing that. And the other part of that is that there really wasn't an arrest warrant. They just told them to go out and to arrest Jesus. There was no legal proceeding. They didn't go through a process to get a document to say, here's the evidence and here's why this man should be arrested. They just wanted him arrested, and so they went out and got him. It seems like Judas, when he made this covenant with them to betray Jesus, it seems like they thought, this is our moment, and so we better act quickly. And they acted so quickly that not only did they not go through the proper, you know, motions to make an arrest, but they didn't even have any witnesses when it came to trial. Nobody had anything against them, and they're trying hurriedly to get somebody to do it, again, under cover of darkness. So the arrest of Jesus was completely illegal. It should have been done openly in the daytime and not, you know, from the Sanhedrin. And then we come to the trial, and they bring Jesus before, you know, the court here, before the Sanhedrin. And we just notice that Peter was following, but afar off. So he came to the palace of the high priest, so where they would be meeting, but he was on the outside warming himself, you know, with those who were not disciples of Jesus. But the chief priests, verse 55 says, they sought for witness against Jesus to put him to death and found none. And so the first thing that is wrong here is that it's in the nighttime again, under the cover of darkness, they're having this trial. The second thing is that it's a private examination of Jesus, that they've just brought him before the court. And now they're saying, we're going to bring in all these people and they're going to accuse you. And so it's a private examination. It's not an open court. There's no jury. There's no public presence. They have Jesus off by himself just to hurl accusations at him. So when we, in our judicial system, you know, we have something like a grand jury, you know, in the grand jury, the only people who present evidence is the prosecution. So the state or whoever is bringing the charges. And the purpose of the grand jury is to decide whether or not we should go to trial. And so this is kind of like a grand jury thing that Jesus has brought before him, them, and they're just making all these accusations against him. But there's no one to determine whether or not they're valid or whether or not this should actually go to trial. They're actually using this as the trial. And so if you've ever served on a grand jury, if that were the only part of the process, everybody would be guilty. Because in a grand jury, all you hear are the accusations. You don't get to hear the defense. And so I say everybody. Sometimes it's so weak that it doesn't go to trial or whatever. But you understand the principle. That's what they're doing here to Jesus. There's no defense. There's no opportunity for him to defend himself. He can only say things that they would then in turn use to incriminate him. So we have the Fifth Amendment where you don't have to testify against yourself. The Jews had that as well. It wasn't the Fifth Amendment, but they had that principle. And so what they're wanting Jesus to do is to say something that they can use against him. Not a fair trial at all, completely unjust and inappropriate. And so the arrest was illegal. This private examination of Jesus is illegal. They had no right to do this before the trial began. And then it says that there arose, from many false witnesses, bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together. So they're calling in people to try to get something on Jesus, and people are saying all kinds of things. None of it is true, and because it's not true, none of the witnesses agree with one another. And that's one of the problems with error, with false doctrine, and with just being dishonest, that there's not a lot of unity in it. There's disagreement, and so the hypocrisy shows and the contradictions show. So it's easy to tell that you're not telling the truth or the truth is not being presented. So they're trying to find witnesses, and these witnesses don't agree with one another. And so, again, immediately the whole case should be thrown out. There's no witness against Jesus. The law of Moses, you had to have at least two or three witnesses to convict somebody of crimes, especially a crime where a person's life was at stake, that had capital punishment with it. And so it was illegal for them to try to make this indictment based on the testimony of false witnesses that didn't agree. And notice also that verse 57, where it says, there arose certain and bear false witness against him, saying, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands. So we heard him say this, which is hearsay, of course, and not reliable testimony, unless it can be backed up by an abundance of witnesses. If 20 people said we heard him say this, then the chances, you know, more that he actually said it. The truth of the matter is that Jesus never said this. And we read that and we think back, well, he talked about the temple and being built, and so, but they said, we heard him say, I will destroy this temple. But that's not what Jesus said. Jesus said, if you destroy this temple, then I will build it back in 3 days. And he was talking about the temple of his body. But he never said, I will destroy the temple. I will destroy the temple of my body, or I will destroy the temple of Jerusalem. Now, he talked about the fact that it was going to be destroyed, but those are not the words that he said. So even when they're trying to accuse him and they use something that he was saying against him, they don't even get it right. But they word it in such a way so it sounds like Jesus threatened to destroy the temple. But even then, they couldn't come to an agreement. So they're trying every way that they can to get something on him, and they're lying and they're dishonest, which again makes the case invalid, and it should be thrown out immediately. As we've mentioned, it was illegal to do this at night. The Sanhedrin wasn't supposed to convene at night. They certainly weren't supposed to question somebody by himself, much less do it at night, and then go through the whole process of producing a verdict, which is really kind of an indictment. This is why they're going to send him to the Roman trial. But to accuse Jesus of something worthy of death in the dark, you know, under the cover of night, was entirely illegal. Not only that, but it says in verse 60, the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, "Answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witness against thee?" But he held his peace. So again, he's asking Jesus to incriminate himself, which he had no legal obligation to do and certainly no moral obligation to do. And so Jesus doesn't answer because they don't have anything on him. There's no reason for him to defend himself against these false accusations because those making them don't even agree with one another. So if the legal system works properly, Jesus doesn't even have to answer and the case gets thrown out. But then the priest says to him, ask him, you know, directly, art thou the Christ, the son of the Messiah, or the son of the blessed? So he's asking, are you the Messiah? Are you the anointed of God? Are you the son of God? And when he's asked that directly, Jesus finally answers. And his answer is very simple. He says, I am. And I am, of course, is a statement of truth, but it also echoes back to I am that I am at the burning bush and God's name being revealed to the children of Israel. So Jesus publicly confesses, I am the Messiah. There are many who try to tell us today that Jesus never claimed to be the Son of God, that he never claimed to be the Messiah, that he never claimed to be deity. And they say that that was a doctrine made up by the church years later or something that Paul taught, but Jesus himself didn't teach. And they say those things for any number of reasons, but there's this idea that Jesus was not God. He was just, you know, a man or whatever. But Jesus publicly claimed that he is the Son of God. And not only here, he had done it many times before, but this is one of the clearest where he says simply, I am. And by the way, in the other gospel accounts, when he's asked, and the King James Version says that he said, thou sayest, that means the same thing as what he says here. It means you say correctly. So it's him saying, I am. So he acknowledges it in the other gospel accounts as well. And then he goes on to say, ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. And Jesus, of course, had already taught this when he talked about coming in judgment on Jerusalem. So they accused him of saying, I will destroy this temple, which was not what he said. But now he says that he is the Son of God, and he's also the Son of Man, and he's going to come in judgment on Jerusalem. And he says, of course, that they will see this. So it was going to happen in their day, AD 70, of course, when that finally happened. So when Jesus says this, the high priest rent his clothes, which, by the way, was illegal. The high priest wore priestly garments, and he was never to tear those garments. So this was a show on his part, like, I'm so outraged at this blasphemy, I'm tearing my clothes. And these are priestly garments. How terrible is this thing that Jesus just did, right? He's trying to make it look worse than it is. But it was against the law of Moses for him to tear those garments. And so he says, what need we any further witnesses? Which kind of makes you understand that it doesn't matter what Jesus said. Once he said something, they were going to say, well, he's admitted it, and so we've condemned him. But they accuse him of blasphemy, which was not blasphemy. It would only be blasphemy if he wasn't the Son of God, but he is, and he'd proven that clearly and conclusively. But they accuse him of blasphemy. The high priest says, "What think ye? So render your verdict." And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And in this book, as he goes through part of the legal process here, he talks about how it was illegal to try Jesus before the morning sacrifice had been offered. That had to be the first thing done as the day began for, you know, the whole Jewish economy to start. And so that was illegal. It was illegal to have this trial on the eve of a Jewish Sabbath and the beginning of Passover. They had no right to it. You remember, they even said earlier that they wouldn't arrest him on the feast day because they didn't want to, you know, cause a tumult among the people. But here they are trying him at night secretly. So as long as the people don't know about it, you know, everything is okay. He also argues that it was illegal to have a trial of this nature with capital punishment in just one day. There had to be time to call witnesses and to have a defense, which, of course, they didn't. It was illegal to convict Jesus with only uncorroborated confession. Even if he confessed something, there had to be corroboration. And that's still true today. Sometimes people claim responsibility for some crime or some murder that's taken place when they really didn't do it. And if there's no evidence to actually link them to that, you can't convict them of the crime. So even if Jesus says something here that they want to convict him of, there has to be corroborating evidence, which they had none. It was illegal to have a unanimous verdict when it came to the death penalty. And that was part of the law of Moses, and he goes into some of that too, which is quite fascinating. But here they all agreed, they all condemned him to be guilty of death. And then he talks about some other irregularities that went along with it and why members of the Sanhedrin were disqualified from actually trying Jesus. They had already expressed their prejudice against him. And so, kind of like a judge today has to recuse himself from a case if he has a personal interest, they obviously had personal interest in seeing Jesus put to death. And so they should not have had anything to do with this. And then the fact that they didn't even let him present a defense and view the merits of his defense shows again how all of this was illegal. So they have had their kangaroo court, you know, their banana republic has worked. Jesus came in already convicted in their minds that he was guilty, and now they found something and they've pronounced him guilty, so they began to spit on him. They covered his face and they would blindfold him, and then somebody would hit him and say, "Okay, you're a prophet. Tell us who just hit you. Prophesy if you're so smart." Right? They're completely mocking him. And Jesus, of course, knew who hit him because he's the Son of God. But he didn't answer a word. The servants did strike him with the palms of their hands. Notice the servants did this. So even the lowest of the low were involved in and joining into this ridicule of the Son of God. Isaiah had prophesied about him that he would be as a lamb led to the slaughter. He would be silent, and that's exactly what he was. He didn't answer their accusations. He didn't retaliate when they attacked him, but he humbled himself to bear this humiliation and this suffering and all that went along with it because he was paying the price for our sins. There was nothing legal about what happened to Jesus. There was no true court case here on the part of the nation of Israel. And when we get over to chapter 15, we'll talk about the Roman side as well and the problems with that also. But we're out of time, so we'll stop here. Lord willing, next week we'll talk about Peter's denial of Jesus, and that will lead us into chapter 15 and then the Roman side of things with Pilate, and we'll look at some of those things also. But we'll stop here, and we'll pick up verse 66 next time.